this is Scriptlock, where we talk about storytelling in video games. My name is Nick Folkman.
And I'm Max Folkman. Today's guests are John Paquette and Mel McCoubrey back again.
Yo.
John works at Insomniac, where he was the lead writer on Marvel Spider-Man, Sunset Overdrive, and Resistance 3. Before that, he was a creative director at EA and wrote on Medal of Honor and Medal of Honor Airborne. And according to IMDb, he also worked in QA on Jurassic Park Trespasser.
That's correct.
Awesome. Mel started out as a scriptwriting intern on Far Cry 4, became a scriptwriter on Assassin's Creed Freedom Cry, the assistant director of narrative design on Assassin's Creed Syndicate, and is currently the narrative director at Ubisoft Quebec, where she just released Assassin's Creed Odyssey.
Hi.
Thank you both for coming on.
And you're both nominated for WGA Awards.
Congratulations, John.
Congratulations, Mel. We'll see you tomorrow night.
Yeah. Dress fancy.
I'll try. I need to iron some clothes.
So, Belle, you came on last time, so I need to ask you this. But, John, how did you get into game writing?
Well, I came to California to go to the graduate screenwriting program at USC. And when I was there, back in those days, they used to actually have physical boards, job boards, where they would put up, job opportunities, internship mostly. And I saw one for a game company, and it said free food, free games, no pay. And I was like, that sounds like me, because I've always been a huge gamer. But I was just looking for, a way to get into the industry. And so that was actually, it didn't say in the thing what it was. So I showed up for the interview, and it turned out to be DreamWorks Interactive, which had just started up. This was like in the beginning when the three guys got together, started that whole studio. So I started there. I worked there for a long time. I'm sure you guys want to ask about Trespasser. It sounds like you were intrigued about that. But, after DreamWorks Interactive got bought by EA and became EALA, I worked in various capacities as a designer, lead designer, creative director, and writer. And then about 10 years ago, got an offer to go to Insomniac as a writer. So that's where I went, and I've been there ever since.
So I will ask about Trespasser.
You had them all grinning over here.
Because for those who don't know, like, Trespasser was a very notorious game for like trying to shoot for the moon and doing a lot of crazy stuff at the time. And then because of its physics engine is what I think I remember from one of the articles about it, right?
Yep.
How was working on that?
So I was the lead tester on that project, and it was crazy. I don't think I've ever worked that much on any game since. I literally slept under my desk because not only was I the lead QA, I also had to start the builds in the morning. So I would like work, testing until, after midnight. And then have to get up at like 2 or 3 in the morning and start the build so that when everybody else showed up, the build would be ready to go. But luckily I was paid hourly. so I didn't know, I never knew that if you worked like so many hours in a day or a week, there was a thing called golden time. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but I made more, as a tester than I did, in the ensuing years as a producer or a designer. So,
wow.
It was, at least I got compensated for it. It was great. It was, crazy. I have many Seamus Blackley stories. He was the lead on that project. There were a lot of really, really smart people, super talented team. We were shooting for the moon. We were trying to, push the boundaries of what games could be, but it was super hard. And I still haven't worked on a game that buggy in my life. I can't believe it actually shipped. And you had to have a really beefy PC in order to play it. My favorite thing, like thinking about, the min specs on that, we told, I think Microsoft was our publisher, we told them that we would hit a certain min spec. And in order to do it, you had to make the game window super small and like super low res, so much so that you could barely see what was happening, but at least then it ran, on the min spec. So if anybody out there has actually played it on the min-spec, kudos to you for figuring out what was going on.
They should remake that game.
There are people that are modding it. They contact, you know, people on the game team every once in a while, and they say, "Hey, we're rebuilding this in so and so or whatever." I think there's modders out there that have done it.
Yeah, it's like the new Black Mesa.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And just as an aside, I don't want to, you know, monopolize talk about Trespasser, but I was at Insomniac. We have a Slack room for our writers, and Sam Maggs is one of the writers, and Mary Kenny just joined, and we have Ben Arfman and Jason Regatz as well, and Kelsey Beecham. And we're all talking about various things in the industry and how, you know, I think Sam was relating a story about how one of the female characters she worked on in another game had like a jiggly butt, and she was like trying to figure out how to, you know, make it not have such a jiggly butt. It was a very sexist kind of thing. And I told him the story about Trespasser when it's a first person shooter, but you can look down and see the main character's boobs. She, you know, had a healthy bosom, and they put physics on those that were completely unbelievable. But, you know, at the time it was like, look, they're moving. It was pretty spectacular.
Advanced for its time in every way.
Yeah.
So you mentioned internships before. Mm-hmm. I will transition from Trespasser.
I have a tech question.
Oh, yeah?
Am I supposed to hear you two in my cans or no?
No.
Okay. Sorry.
I can't do that both at the same time, like hear John and hear ourselves.
Okay, no,
so.
Just wondering. Didn't want it to be
you
like...
You can tell Mel is a
problem.
Professional. She's been in the VO booth many times. Yeah. She calls them cans.
I do all like the temp stuff. Like whenever we have like temp recordings, when I was an intern at Montreal, they'd ask me to do all the temp voices for like their cartoon shows and stuff that they would have, and like any little like Rabbids projects and crazy shit. So I do a lot of the like temp voice acting.
I'm keeping this in. But you mentioned internships, and Ubisoft and Insomniac both have writing internships, I think. So could both of you talk about what writing interns do at your studios? Because that's pretty uncommon for other studios, I think.
Who do you want to start?
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. Well, I think it depends on like what the studio, for Ubisoft at least, what the studio is looking for, and who is kind of running the internship. So like when I was an intern at Ubisoft Montreal, the internships were run out of Alice, which is their talent part of the studio. And there I was brought on for 3 months, and I got to work very closely with the head of the script writing in general at Ubisoft Montreal at the time, Corey May. And I got to look at all the different projects that were going on at the time, read the AAA scripts, and give critique and feedback to the writers that were writing them with Corey. And then I would also be brought on to do smaller things that I guess they needed like extra help on. So like I worked on the tutorials for Black Flag. I wrote like a trailer for a companion app for another project. And then I worked on like Barks or like AI Lines for different projects as well at Ubisoft Quebec. And I think what is happening now at Ubisoft Montreal is they're hiring interns by project. So it's not like a global studio vision. It's just project related. And so on our side, we have a script writing internship that's open during production, and it is about 6 months long. And depending on where you are in the production cycle at that moment, you learn different things. But I generally like it when the interns learn as much as humanly possible. And I think that's one of the benefits of being an intern when Montreal had them as a global like studio internship, was I got to touch so many different projects, and they were in so many different parts of production at different times depending on what I was working on. And so I got to experience a lot. And so I wanted to make sure that if we were going to have an internship through Quebec, that it would provide a similar opportunity for other people.
Cool.
Well, that sounds super cool. And the fact that you got to write the tutorial for Black Flag, I remember those tutorials specifically. I was like, this is fucking Shakespeare. Like, this is the best tutorial.
Yeah. All right. The capitalization scheme was weird in that game, you know?
I forgot about that.
Well, you know, it's funny. This is for Insomniac, this is the first time we've had an internship for writing. So I don't have a good answer to your question. We have interns come every year over the summer, and it's usually for all the other departments. And you know, after last year, I said, hey, can we get a writing intern? Because there's so many people, so many students and young people come up to me and say, do you guys have internships? And I always have to say, no. And I was like, well, you know, there's obviously demand out there, right? So why don't we do one? And they were like, sure. So I don't know what our intern is going to do. We're actually interviewing right now. I have a bunch of phone screens next week with a bunch of really smart people. And it's crazy how well educated these people are. I don't know what they're teaching them, but the, you know, the way that they speak and their maturity and everything, I'm like, you don't sound like a student, you know, like most of these people just, you know, sound like regular game devs. It's crazy. But we'll see what project is on fire the most when they arrive, and then we'll probably just throw them on that.
Do you know how long the internship is for?
However long that lasts, until they go back to school. It's definitely for like student credit. So you have to be an active student, and you have to, you know, be getting credit for 3-year university.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That sounds cool, though. I'll go more into actual games you guys just released. When you two first started working on your latest game, Spider-Man and Assassin's Creed, what do you feel they were about, or was the core thing you wanted to get across, and did that stay consistent all the way until release, or did it evolve?
Take it away, John.
Well, you know, we had a lot of discussions early on with Marvel, people from Marvel and Sony, and our creative director at Marvel, Bill Roseman, you know, one of the first things he said was that the best Spider-Man stories are when Peter's world and Spider-Man's worlds collide. And so that was kind of called a pillar or a theme or a controlling idea or whatever. We really tried to keep that in mind throughout. And whenever we had moments where people would say, we would do usability tests all the time, and testers would say, I just want to be Spider-Man. You know, I don't care about the Peter thing. I just want to swing around the city. It's like, that's cool. But in order to make this feel like you're fulfilling the fantasy of being Spider-Man, Peter Parker is half of his life, right? So we really wanted to focus on that idea that whenever Peter wins, Spider-Man loses, and whenever Spider-Man wins, Peter loses, right? Like there's a balance there that, and I think that's the core to what makes him such a great character for all of us whenever we watch a movie or read a comic or play a game about Spider-Man, is that we see ourselves in him, right? Like we have two lives. We have our work lives and our home lives, and we're always trying to balance those two. And we like to imagine that our superheroes are actually people. And I think he's one of those superheroes that he's not only a person, he's a likable person who screws up all the time. He's relatable. So I think that's probably the main thing that we tried to stay focused on.
Was it hard to reconcile having such a large history with Spider-Man? Like, you know, you're working with a brand that's been around for such a long time, and you're making like a game version of it that's not the game of a movie. Yep. Was that a challenge in order to kind of like choose what angle you were going to go with?
It was certainly, it was really stressful at the beginning because you're like, oh man, you know, are we going to get compared to this? Are we going to do better than this? But what we ended up doing was, you know, we did our research. I mean, most of us had grown up reading and playing and watching Spider-Man and stuff. But we did our research, and then we said, you know what, we're going to forget all of that. And we're going to look inside of us and say, what does Spider-Man mean to us? What is our version of Spider-Man? And just trust that when we finished it, it would come off as feeling simultaneously fresh and new, but also familiar. Right. And thankfully, I think it sort of worked out. We didn't piss off too many people. I think that's what anytime you start a franchise or a character that is well known and well loved, you have to find the love within yourself and then do your version of that and hope that the love comes through on screen.
I'm all about the love. Yeah. I'm all about these feels right now.
What about you, Mel?
We were really lucky, actually, and I can't say that this is always like this, especially in AAA, but the game we set out to make, we made. So I felt very lucky about that. You know, like the first treatment of the story basically stayed the same throughout the entire process. I think only one of the regions moved in terms of where it hit in the story. But otherwise we maintained the same beats and stuff. For us, it was always about family, and bringing, Assassin's Creed back to, a more personal place. We work with a really large brand with, a lot of mystery, and there's the sci-fi elements, there's the fantastical elements, there's the history to it, and we wanted to make sure that in order to hit all of those, we also needed to make sure that the experience you were going through was a grounded and personal experience, and so that's what we set out to make, and it still stayed like that. We wanted to make sure that you would be pursuing your family members, and you would get big decisions that you have to make when you encounter them, and whether or not you're going to be somebody who, goes it alone and, rejects that personal life, or somebody who tries to reconcile it.
What about scoping? Did you guys have moments where the production team came back to you and said, we can't do all of this in the time that we have. What did you decide to do then?
We mostly just were like, hey, this is what we're going to do. And we're like, okay, let's do it.
You're so lucky.
I'm pretty sure people were like, that's crazy. Yeah. But we still got it out there. And there's a lot of content, but it's been really cool. I mean, in order to, accommodate that, we had to have a giant team to do it. If we had been 20 people, that would have been a lot more difficult than like a team of writers that equals 23.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Like, John, same question to you that you just asked Mel. What did you do when the scope people came back and saying, oh, I don't know about this?
I mean, it's an interesting conundrum because in the beginning, Marvel and Sony and Insomniac were all like, all right, we're going to make a game of the year, right? Like, we're going to go all out.
Congratulations. No, but I mean,
what that translates to when you're early on in the project is you put this huge story with all of these characters and all of these fantastic moments in a treatment, right? And people read the treatment and they're like, oh yeah, if we make this game, it's going to be great. And then you start making the game and it's like, holy shit, we can't do all this. So then there's the time of reckoning, where you have to go back to the treatment and say, okay, if one mission equals this many man months and we only have this many man months left, how do we then trim in order to fit our ship date? And I think every game writer has gone through this, and you do various things. At first, I tried to cut major characters, and that did not go over well because people really wanted these characters in the game. So then it just becomes, okay, how do you trim missions or look at your story moments that were, like when you're constructing an experience, you try to milk moments in order to have bigger drama and whatever. So instead of milking all those moments, we had to kind of, compact them and combine certain elements so that the story would move forward faster. So I'm sure, if you played it, you can probably sense in the third act, there were a lot of things that we said, all right, we're okay with moving fast in the third act because I think most people are going to want to get to the end by that point. But we did see some criticism from our testers, from our usability testers, that, the third act was a little too quick.
Since we're talking about length now, how do both of you decide, how has the decision come up about the length of your games?
Oh, man. I don't think we really, I mean, when we start, we say, okay, people are going to pay full price for this game, right? Whatever that is anywhere. And, since I've been in the industry, the idea of, or I guess the expectation of a full price experience keeps going up, up and up and up. And Mel, I think last week or earlier this week, I was telling you, like, when GTA 5 came out, I was like, fuck those guys. Like, you know, like, there's so much in that game that, you know, now people, me included, as a gamer, when I buy a game, I'm going to be expecting all of these things in that game. So now we have to...
Don't take that quote.
Don't take that quote out of context.
I don't want John to get in trouble.
But it's like, you know, you see that and you're like, okay, they just raised the bar. Now let's raise the bar ourselves. That's the long way of saying, I think it changes with every game nowadays. Every time you start a new game, you're like, okay, we got to give them more.
Yeah, and I think, too, that depends on, like, what game you're making, because I think you can raise the stakes in other ways, you know, for us. I've worked on Assassin's Creed for a long time now, and a lot of it is about the history and the landscape of the world that you're building in that moment in time, whether it's Victorian London, ancient Greece, ancient Egypt, whatever. And so I think the first impulse in terms of giving the players more to experience for us is let's build more of a world to explore. And so I think for Odyssey, one of the first things that came up in like preconception was this map is going to be big. And then we're like, okay, the story's got to be big and there's got to be a lot of content in here so that we can help you explore it and teach you about it as well. Because, you know, it is very much, it is like a fun experience, but it's also a learning experience with Assassin's Creed. And so, for the story, at least, we knew the map was going to be big. We knew we wanted to push you to major, major locations in ancient Greece. And so we ended up creating and kind of pacing the story like a Greek play, like an ancient Greek play, instead of like a three-act structure. I mean, there's still a three-act structure in it, but it is a very, like, long, drawn-out, Odyssey-like experience. Like, we wanted it to feel more like an ancient epic or an ancient play, and I think it was the right choice in terms of the scale of the entire project.
Well, I think something that you guys did that was really smart, I don't know what the first game that did it was. It might have been Origins, where you kind of have, just let-me-learn mode. I'm sure there's a term for it. I forgot what it was.
Exploration mode.
Yeah. That essentially, you build these worlds, and Assassin's Creed has done this for years. You build these worlds that are super fun and interesting to explore, and then you just added a layer on top of it that was like, okay, if you want to just explore and learn, we'll give you a bunch of facts that you can learn, and you can, you know, do it in an interactive way.
Right, like the discovery tour.
Yeah, which totally makes the value of that AAA package go up, at least in my mind. It's like, oh, you're offering a whole new experience that I'm sure didn't cost you guys a whole lot to create, or maybe it did.
I'm not really the right person to ask about this. Yeah. I'm only the narrative director.
It's true.
And it's insane how many like history professors or people who were like in history classes come up to me at like promotional events or conventions or whatever and say like, oh yeah, I learned about X by playing Assassin's Creed. And so I always have to make sure like, all right, then we got to make sure that what we're putting in there is as truthful as we can possibly make it, but entertaining and valuable to the player at the same time, in terms of like a fun and relatable experience as well.
That's got to be super satisfying, knowing that people come up to you and say, you know, you're helping me learn. Like, that's just amazing.
Well, it makes sense to me because I learned so much doing these things that I feel like I come out like a top scholar of like Victorian London or something when I'm done. And I'm like, did you know?
With Spider-Man is a shorter game than Assassin's Creed by orders of magnitude.
Yeah.
But with a certain length of games, how do you fight against making the players feel like the story is wheel spinning? Make sure everything is tight.
Yeah. Well, you do have to make sure everything is tight. And I mentioned earlier, we do a lot of usability testing, and we gather a lot of feedback, and we are not afraid to change things. We're not afraid to throw things out if they feel like padding, we're not afraid to, to rewrite things from scratch if it feels like it's not fitting with the overall narrative, you know, which is kind of terrifying. But at the same time, I think that's what you need to do in order to get to good. We all know that as writers, our first drafts suck, right?
Yes.
And so, you know, you can do as much planning as you want, but until you get the game playable from beginning to end, with like all the you know, cutscenes in there and all the VO in there, you're not really going to know how it feels. And there's going to be some bumpy spots. So you got to, you know, like I said, have that moment of reckoning where you make those hard choices.
How early before release did you have that kind of like playable build for Spider-Man?
Probably 6 or 8 months, I would say we could get a sense of, we could squint and, you know, get a sense for how things were going. Although it's funny, you know, in the usability tests in the last few months, our story scores, you know, cause I don't know if your listeners kind of understand usability, but basically they bring people into a room off the street and they let them play the game for a few days and they ask them a bunch of questions as they're playing the game. You know, the Sony usability lab was great because they gather all of this data and then they munge it and put it into graphs and stuff and tell you, you know, are they comprehending the story? Are they enjoying the story? And of course, there's a bunch of gameplay and design metrics as well. But I would always look at the story scores and see, okay, as long as we can get to base comprehension, I'll feel like we've done our job. And that's probably the most difficult thing for any game writer to do is to make sure that as people are playing through your game, they understand who they are, where they are, what they're supposed to do, you know, that kind of thing. But near the end, in the last few months, we saw the story scores just, you know, increasingly go up and up and up. But we hadn't changed anything in the story. Like, all that was happening was that the cutscenes were getting, you know, like a final lighting pass. You know, a lot of the sound mixing was happening. It's like things were being polished, but nothing was changing in the story. But the player's experience of the story was getting better and better, which is terrifying as well because it's like people judge the story based on how things look when, you know, that's not really what we do as much.
Yeah. Mel, I saw you nodding a lot when John was talking about playability and how important that is and having a full build of the game.
I do, like, I agree that, like, for us, it is very important that we get a fully playable experience in our hands in order to know what it feels like, in order to make tweaks. That's a hugely important part of the process.
Yeah. Mel, how often do you not just make tweaks, but make, like, big changes once you get to that point?
What's a big change to you, John?
Big change is, like, hey, our act two climax isn't hitting. We need to write a new scene or rewrite the scene or just, you know, like add a couple missions, you know, around there in order to help people understand why this is such a big deal, that kind of thing.
It depends. On Odyssey, we knew that the introduction to the experience was hugely important, a hugely important aspect of the game. You know, we did change a few things in the methodology of Assassin's Creed. And so we knew we were going to have to introduce it in a different way than what I think we would normally do it. And we wanted players to be able to ease in, take their time, get to know the world, get to know the island of Kefalonia, get to know the characters before throwing a wrench in and upping the stakes for the big plot. And so the intro of the game, not the Battle of the 300, but the tutorial section on Kefalonia, we did rewrite 2 or 3 times in completion, just because we knew that experience had to be right.
Yeah.
It had to suck people in, and it had to teach people the new stuff in the game, or just introduce this Assassin's Creed to new people.
Yeah, tutorials are always like that, and I bet, like, throughout development, you guys had multiple takes on how you were teaching the player various things, and those got thrown out as you did testing and so on and so forth.
Yeah, but I mean, for this one, it was very much like an introduction to the way the world was going to work, the way the quest system was going to be revealed to the player was very different, because we used to have like a mission-based structure in other Assassin's Creed, and now we're moving to a quest-based structure, which is shorter moment-by-moment experience with greater rewards and twists that come earlier in the experience, rather than having like a three-hour like mission. And this was brand new for us. And so, that was really important when we were tutorializing, was not just like, how do you use these mechanics, but how is this game going to play out? We needed to have it in a small section that people could actually like get attuned to and figure out how kind of the rest of the game would work based on that.
John, those problems you were describing before, like, and Mel, you could answer this too. Is there a way, do you think you can prepare for those problems enough so that like you can solve them before they would show up, or is it always dependent on the game? Like, you'll always encounter those kinds of problems no matter what.
I think you can solve, a fair amount of them ahead of time, just with great communication between, your narrative team and your design team. But there are going to be new problems that show up. And I think that's just the nature of making games is that, I don't know. I've never talked to anybody who makes games that, gets it right on the first time. And so, you'll get some things right and players will respond to it. But like I said, base comprehension is so hard to get that there's just too many moving parts not for something to get screwed up when you put it together.
The firefighting hat and the creative hat are the same hat.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, just an extension of that, I think having really clear and strong pillars or vision statement or themes or whatever it is that you X statement, whatever it is you use to, this is what the creative director does, right? Like, that person is there to say, this is what this game is about. So when, as Mel said, you put on that firefighter hat, when you have to make those creative decisions, you go back to that statement and you say, this game is about Peter's worlds and Spider-Man's worlds colliding, right? So now that we have to decide what we're going to do in this, one tiny little moment in this mission, how do we fix that in a way that supports the theme?
And like, games are hugely, hugely collaborative. And that's, I think, what sets them apart from other mediums in a way, is that like every decision you make impacts somebody mm-hmm. else at some point. And it's probably like a $50,000 decision. And so it's really important. I think one of like the things that I always try to tell my writers that work with me, or anybody else that, I'm giving advice to in the industry, is because it's so collaborative, it's your responsibility as a developer to always put your best ideas forward. Like, always give the best ideas that you can. Like, don't give like problem like solution like X and Y and Z, like give A, B, and C and try to be as creative and collaborative as humanly possible in order to, I guess, preemptively get some of those issues out of the way. But then also when you're encountering them, that you can solve them in a way that is creatively satisfying, good for the project. It is possible.
Yeah. And jumping on that, we are all storytellers. Everybody on the dev team is a storyteller, right? So they have their own tools that they can use to create a story. As a writer, we have our tools. As a sound designer, they have their own tools. As an animator, artist, you name it. And Max and Nick, I was listening to one of your previous podcasts, and it was one where Cara Ellison and Rihanna Pratchett and Jill Murray, I think, were talking, and one of them brought up the idea that the writer is sort of the ambassador of meaning, which I thought was a really cool term, and I'm going to totally steal it. But I think part of the job of a writer on a game team is to be that person in those moments when stuff goes wrong and people have to come up with these, as Mel puts it, these A, B, and C ideas. Say, okay, this is the box we need to work in, though, right? Like, this is our goal. This is what this mission or this cinematic or this whatever means. This is what we're trying to do with this now. How can we solve that in a way that, helps us hit our dates and stays within budget?
Mm-hmm. Could you possibly give an example of that happening on Spider-Man? If you can't, that's totally understandable.
Yeah. I'm trying to think.
Or Assassin's Creed.
Well, I mean, you know, I did mention earlier we had moments of scoping, right? And those are always where the discussions, I mean, it's not just, oh, let's cut this mission and do that. There are always creative problems, because you can't just remove something without upsetting everything else. So, like I said earlier, we were going for Game of the Year, so we had this huge story that just didn't fit in our timeline. And we had to do a lot of discussion about how do we get rid of this stuff without getting rid of the stuff that people like. So in an example, I remember trying to get rid of main characters. I tried to get rid of Silver Sable as a character. I tried to get rid of MJ as a character.
MJ?
You're heartless.
Yeah, I tried to get rid of Miles as a character. It's like, you know, I brought up all those ideas because not really did I want to make a game without those characters, but in order to help people understand that the goal here is that we need to reduce the amount of story that we have. And we could do that by removing Miles. We could do that by removing Aunt May. We could do that by removing Norman Osborn. And then that brings up a discussion where people are like, oh, but I really like that one thing. You know, Silver Sable's badass. We really want to have her in there. Okay, well, then how about this? How about, you know, and then it just becomes a creative discussion.
Mine would, I guess, you'd have to know a bit about Greek geography in order to understand. But basically, there was a pacing issue between Chapter 3 in Assassin's Creed, which took place in Delphi, which is like a little bit like north of where you start.
Yeah.
And then Chapter 4 was in Athens, and there's a giant landmass in between those two, in between those two places. And we hadn't had enough of naval experience, like a boat experience on the boat. Before then, you have a little bit in between Chapter 1, which is in Cephalonia, and Megaris, which is Chapter 2. And we wanted to bring back the boat. So instead of having you could, because it's an open world, run from, or horseback ride, from Delphi all the way through like Boeotia, which is like level 40, to Athens, which is like level 15, 20.
Yeah.
Or we could encourage you to go on the boat and go around and then take you into what we call like a naval playground. And also in that, and by doing that, open up different parts of the world that weren't just main path. So we could, you know, allow you to go kind of explore the other side quests that were happening at that time. So that's kind of like one of the solutions to that problem.
How much of it is it a headache to, this is related to the question I'll ask right after this, but like how much of a headache is it to have to account for so many different possibilities of what the player could do? Because the world is so big and like, maybe they'll take the boat. Maybe they'll go through that level 40 area. Maybe they can do this thing.
We always set out to say like, you know what, you play it your way. And we will try our best to tailor that experience to however you want to do it. But, you know, if you go off path, that's not wrong.
No.
And we never want to tell you that that's wrong. But you're going to have to find your way back, you know, if you want to continue this thread or this other thread. Like, there are different ways to go about it. So instead of trying to, like, kill yourself by making like 1,000 different opportunities of ways in, you know, we would pick like a good solid like 10 ways into something, or, you know, try to imagine what the player experience was at that point. It's like, well, they could go off and go in this direction, or they could kind of stay with the story as we have it now, or they could have tried to clear out this area before continuing on. So we kind of looked at what we thought would be major experiences first. Because, again, you know, time, budget, a release date on the horizon. If you get bogged down by every single opportunity ever, it will make your project suffer.
So my related question was, what's the hardest part about writing for an open world?
Ooh, that's a great question.
Oh, I have an answer.
Do it.
I know what it is. For us, and this harkens back to a question you asked earlier, for us would be pacing. It's so hard to guess what a player's pace is going to be like, but also we don't, like, we want you to be able to play it in whatever way you want, and so we want to encourage you to go out there and explore the world, like, especially in Assassin's Creed Odyssey, there's so many points of interest. We want you to see it. We want you to meet all of these characters that aren't on the main path too, and so we try to open it up at different points so that it's very much like, go out there, go out to the world, be brave, meet these people, do these things. But it does make it hard, you know, if we were to have gone with like the very traditional 3X structure, that would have been like really difficult, because then you're trying to force a linear like situation into something that's not supposed to be linear. So, you know, I don't think anybody's really figured it out completely yet, but it's always that fine balance between what is the player doing and how can we suck them into different experiences and have them, you know, still be as emotionally impacted as possible.
Yeah, I think that's really smart. You know, you were talking about how you really have to advertise to the player that there's a bunch of stuff out there for you to do, but you don't want to tell them they have to do that kind of stuff. I think that's a big challenge. I think another challenge is that inherently you want a really good, polished kind of main story, because there's a lot of players out there who their style of play is just to play the story, right? Like, they don't want to mess around in the open world. But you can't have too much urgency in that. Otherwise, the open world, you know, loses meaning, right? Or people will never go out into the open world. So you kind of have to design your story so that there are things for that the player or the player character needs to do. But it's not like, oh my God, this building is on fire, I have to go do that right now. It's, you know, you might want to go over there to that building at some point. But if you want to go do this other thing, you can do that too.
It could be on fire.
Yeah, it might be on fire. But, you know, and you know, the famous term is ludonarrative dissonance, right? Like there's a lot of games that you play where it's like they're telling you, you have to go do this. And you're like, I don't feel like going to do that. I'm going to go do this other thing. And then it's just, like, if there's a battle that's going on, it's just a stalemate until you get there, right? And it's clear that that is happening. But I think it's a big challenge when you have open world to appeal to both those kinds of play styles. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, like, for me, like, personally, as a player, like, I hate it when I'm given all this opportunity to do other things, but then I'm constantly being pulled in one direction only. And, you know, there's a 5-hour tutorial session where where they're trying to tell me, like, this is how you plant plants, and this is how you do this other thing, and this is how you craft. And then it's like, but no, the urgency is, your mom died, and now you have to do X, Y, and Z, and there's this, like, terrible thing on a mountain, but you can do the farming later.
Yeah.
I don't know what that game was, but it sounded amazing.
Yeah. I want to play it. Yeah.
Is that Stardew Valley?
Stardew Valley with, like, a really dramatic plot.
I'd play that.
Stardew of War.
Yeah.
Right. How should we transition?
Do a hard left.
Or do like a musical interlude.
Yeah.
This is the next question, brought to you by the Folkman Twins.
Nope. All right. What is the worst professional advice you've ever received?
I have things that like make me mad and I don't think are very helpful most of the time.
I'll take it.
Which is quit. Like, come on.
In response to what?
Anything. Like, just like, I feel like this is a huge one in creative industries in general, like whether you're a novel writer or you're, an author, sorry, or, you know, you want to work in film or you want to work somewhere and they're like, don't, I hate that. And the other one is like, oh, well, if it's difficult or whatever, just leave and go somewhere else. Like, that's not very helpful to me. And the other one is, pick your battles is hard because I understand the context behind it. Like, you know, you don't want to be like you don't want to fight over literally everything. Like, that will make you somebody horrible to collaborate with.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, why does everything have to be a fight? And like, why does everything have to be a battle? There are things that you can do in order to, like, not feel ashamed of having to let something slide. Like, there are better solutions than just giving up, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever received this advice, but I know there are people out there that believe this. And it's like, I've heard sometimes, you know, somebody's got to be the asshole. Somebody's got to be the bad guy, right? And that might be the easy way out in order to get things done. But I feel like games as a business, as a creative endeavor, is just so collaborative that you should never underestimate the power of being a good person and having people believe in you and want to work with you.
Mel is touching her heart.
No, but it's true. Like
I know, we're just too squishy to be the asshole's job.
Maybe that's what it is. But honestly, like making games is so hard that everybody's going to get burned out. Everybody's going to get angry and stressed out. That the more enjoyable you can do it, and the more you can make it feel like we're all in this together, and we all just want to make something great, then I think the less stress and anxiety and kind of strife you'll have on your team. And I think that just pays dividends in the final game. When people are happier and are bought in and really believe in what they're doing, the end result is going to be better.
My creative director will hate this if he ever listens. And only because I say this like multiple times a day. Every day is like teamwork makes the dream work, and friendship is the answer.
Yeah.
Like I think I'm a walking cartoon character most of the time, where I'm just like, yeah, friendship will solve all of our problems. And he's like, if you say friendship one more time.
Yeah, but you know, Mel, that brings up a good point. Like, I think one of the important parts of a game writer's job is to kind of be a cheerleader, right? Like, you need to be that person on your team that says, I believe in what we're doing. I think all the work you guys are doing is really cool. You know, you may not see it right now, but, you know, in the end, this is all going to come together and it's going to be great. And you know, I can't believe I'm so lucky to work with all of you who are really talented.
Yeah. I think especially as a lead, you have to do that. And I think this is the same for juniors and seniors, but on most games, it takes so long to see the final product. Like, 3 years may seem like a short time in order to push out a big game, but it's still 3 years. That's a long time in a lifespan. Mm-hmm. 3 years for a game, 4 years for a game, 5 years for a game, however long it takes you. And you don't see the end result until the very end, and you don't see it all come together, and you don't see how people are going to react to it, and all you can do is hope for the best. And I think it's really easy to lose sight of the immense and creative work that you're doing and all of the love and energy that you're putting in. So as a lead, you have to remind people of that, especially too, like, if you're part of a big studio, only some people get to do like the promotional stuff. Only some people get to go out and meet the people who are playing your game, unless you spend a lot of time on social media or whatever. And so sometimes it's really hard to gauge, like, if what you're doing is good or not, and if people are actually enjoying it. And so as a lead, you have to be there to be like, you're awesome. Like, you keep making amazing things. We're all going to make something amazing together. Like, nobody is in this to make something shit. Everybody is in this process to make something amazing. And it's important to remind people of that. So you can use my teamwork makes the dream work and annoy everybody at your office
too. I will totally do that. Yeah, it's funny because every project has ups and downs, and every project I've ever been on has had that moment of despair where it's like, all it takes is for one person at the top to say, you know what, this just isn't going to work. And then everybody loses faith and then the project will crumble, right? Like I think you're always on that precipice of you know, as long as we all believe in what we're doing, we can take these things that are objectively bad right now. Like, no one who comes in and plays this is going to enjoy this. But the more we work on it and the more we believe that it's going to be great, the greater it will be.
Yeah, and I think that really relates to script writing in games in general and in anything, probably, is that you need to feel it when you're making it. And you can totally tell when you're reviewing something if somebody didn't feel what they were. Mm-hmm. They were right. I'm all about feelings and emotions. I'm sorry, guys. It's just how it is.
We're here for that.
I have a lot of feelings. I am like empath to the power of 3,000. And like, I instinctively know when somebody hasn't felt what it is they're writing. And it's like, all right, then we have to go back and look at who is this person? Why do they matter to the player? Why do they matter to you? How can we bring that out more than that already exists here? How can we make it work with the gameplay that you guys have collaborated on with your quest designers or your the scenes you want to do with your cinematic designers to really bring those feelings out? I end up just having conversations about feelings with a lot of people.
Like, along those same lines, how do you maintain a healthy work-life balance?
It's hard. It's hard. You know, I've been doing this for a long time. I think I mentioned, you know, I had multiple 100-hour weeks when I was starting out. I reached a point in my life, in my career, where I said, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm not going to sleep at work. You know, I think that was definitely a 90s thing, but it was also when you're young and you're really passionate about what you're doing and you really love it, you're going to do whatever you can to make it great. But I think the industry has grown up. I think a lot of us understand that if you burn yourself out, the game is not going to be great. You need to, there's a lot of analogies. You know, you want to be running fast, but not sprinting all the time. You want to be able to find time to, you know, I use the bathtub. Like I'll say to people at work, I need to go home and take a bath, you know, and that's like, that's a code word for, you know, John's not in his head, right now. He needs to find, you know, the meaning, but everybody has their own way of doing that. But work-life balance is something that I think we will always struggle with because, games and I think any creative endeavor, they can just eat you up. Like if you care about it and you want it to be great, you can work on it 24/7. So you gotta handle that yourself. And I say this to everybody that I work with, is that you gotta find that balance, whatever works for you. I don't know about how you guys do that, but I'm always curious to hear how other people handle stress and anxiety and how they balance that.
It's weird for us because we're brothers and like we're living together right now. So we're always, if one of us sees the other one struggling, it's like we can help with that. We're never like,
oh, my wife, alone. Believe me, like having somebody at home that understands that is really valuable.
Oh, yeah.
But freelance is always stressful and I'm never happy about, even when we have work, it's like, well, this job's going to end in a month or so. I need to find another job.
I should probably go like spend time right now working on that job instead of enjoying my free time and taking a bath.
And it would be nice to have healthcare,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We had that conversation, John and I, this week, where he was talking about the bath and I was like, yep, lightning strikes in the shower for sure.
Bathroom, yeah. Shower in the morning, using a toothbrush at night, that's everything for
me. It's funny because it's like work-life balance and stress and the creative process are so like interconnected for me that like my brain never shuts off. Like I have to do things so that I don't think about work. Like I have, because otherwise like it'll come back. Like I have dreams about work, about even some of like the most mundane, like, did I send that email or didn't I send that email to the actor that's recording in this booth in my dream is upset about the role.
It sounds like a nightmare.
And so I constantly, like, my brain doesn't really turn off very well. And so, like, I'm always, and because it's a creative job, like, I'm always thinking about how could we make this better? What if this character actually felt this thing? And so I have to do things in order to kind of turn that part off. And kind of related is when you're finishing a project, it's like finishing, like I used to be in theater. And so it's kind of like finishing a show. It's like you had like a run with a show for, I don't know, several weeks, for some people, several months. And then when it's done, it's like you have this like emotional hole in you and you're just like, oh my goodness, like all of that energy, that all of that adrenaline you had that keeps you going, like whoosh, like that it comes out. And it's like, so you have to be good at being able to deal with that. And so one of the things that I've learned over the past like 6 months is like how to really take care of myself in terms of like self-care, whether it be through like, I don't know, some kind of like beauty regime or like skincare regime to, I listen to a lot of audiobooks. Like I have them on all of the time, whether I'm walking to work, walking the dog, doing the dishes, whatever. I always listen to something so I can think about something else and analyze somebody else's stuff instead of my own. And like one of the things that's really related to that is, and I'm sure like you, John, can relate, is that, you know, when you're a creative, sometimes it's not only the job that you do that needs to be creatively stimulated. Like I used to draw and I used to be in like competitive choirs and I used to do theater and I also do write still. But what I do at Ubisoft a lot of times will fill a lot of those holes, but so it's like, you know, I do a lot of promotional work for the game, so that gets like the theater energy out. And I write at work, but I also like sing to my dog all the time. And instead of drawing on paper, now I draw in my face. And like that stuff needs to come out. Otherwise, there's like a buildup of stress in that respect too. So it's been a learning experience this year, that's for sure. But it's been a good thing to learn. The more you learn about how you deal with creative pressure and stress and your own creative needs as a dev, like the better you're going to be.
Yeah, that's a great point, Mel. And I think that's important for anybody listening who's a game dev to take away, is that you need to always be listening to your body, listening to your mind, and kind of sensing when things are getting out of balance. And you got to find that yourself. I know so many people, myself included, who throughout their careers have hit the wall. And that's what I call it. You hit the wall. And that's, you know, for me, it was like, I literally thought I was dying. You know, I was like, oh, okay. I have no appetite. There must be some kind of horrible cancer inside of me somewhere. I'm going to the doctor. And then, you know, everything test after test. And it was like, you know, I think you're just stressed out. And I didn't understand that mental stress could affect your body in that way, right? And it was only after that self-learning that I understood what I needed to do. And I then made an effort to try various different things in order to help it. I found that exercise works really well for me. When I'm stressed out, I will go for a run. I do not enjoy running, but I enjoy having taken a run.
That's like writing.
Exactly.
Well, you never regret a workout after.
Exactly. Yeah.
That is somebody gave me that sage advice. One of my writers gave me that sage advice, and it's fucking true.
Yeah. Yeah.
I kickbox, okay? And usually my ass gets kicked instead of me feeling like I kicked anybody's ass.
Right, but then after doing that, you know, then you have this release, you know, there's some chemicals probably being released in your brain somehow. And all of a sudden,
and you feel good about yourself. And that's also a huge part of dealing with stress. It's like being confident in you and liking who you are. And so like I always send my boyfriend a text after I work out. And I'm like, I'm buff again. Like, here's the six pack exists. Oh, it's gone. But it'll be gone tomorrow. But I have it right now.
Yeah, that's great.
Has it been harder to maintain a healthy work-life balance the more you've advanced in your careers? Has it gotten easier?
No, I've always been like crazy. Like I always have been like 130% on whatever I'm doing. And it's just learning how to notice your signs when you're getting like overworked or like overwhelmed from something, and learning how to cope with that I find. And maybe it's just because I am still young that I have, maybe, I don't know, in 20 years, ask me that again. Maybe I'll be like, yeah, whoa, like 20-year-old Mel was crazy, man. Like now I just sit on my lawn chair and don't do anything. I don't know.
Your body will catch up with you.
Yeah, but like I know that if I start to have like an emotional like hair trigger to like response to things, like I just like burst out into tears and like, oh, maybe this is like time to chill out, go pet your dog, Mel, like figure out what's happening.
Yeah, I don't think for me it's gotten any easier. I think I've just gotten smarter in recognizing when things are going awry and then how to cut it off when it's happening. I do think that I had a kid like 5 years ago. My son is five. He just turned five. And that really kind of changed the way that I see the world. And you know, when like the first time I came home and I was super stressed out and he came up to me and hugged me and said, hi, Dad. It was like all the stress from the day just went away. And I was like, okay, this relationship and this, you know, family dynamic that I have is really, really important to me. I want to make sure that I maintain that balance. So the whole like beating myself up for leaving before other people at night, I've grown beyond that. Like, I don't give a shit anymore. Like if I feel like I've done my work for the day and you know, I'm ready to go home, I'm going to go home.
Honestly, yeah. Though, I think I said all that stuff. And one of the best things in life to have when you're at game dev is like, I mean, if you're irresponsible, it's not a good thing. But for me, having a dog is like the clockwork that I live by. It's like that dog needs human contact. And so I will go home to provide the dog with human contact. Like he goes out 4 times a day. So I know when I have to.
He needs me.
Yeah, he needs me. And like, I can't speak to having a child equivalent, but he's fairly close to my heart. And so I like, if I ever have to work overtime, like I will try and do it from home, but generally speaking, I know when I have to leave. I know when I have to put things down and say like, hey, I have other people, other beings in my life that I have to attend to, and that's totally normal human experience, Mel. Good for you.
All right, I'm going to start doing some more non-sequitur questions.
Non-sequitur transition. Here's the next question. Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. This one we're going to try to ask more from now on because we should have been asking from the beginning. Who do you think is the or one of the most underrated people working with game storytelling these days? Like, it could be a writer, a narrative designer, like a level designer, someone who works in sound, anything.
I had an answer for this and now I've forgotten, so hold on.
We'll cut out the good thing we get out of these pauses. Yeah.
Well, you know, I whenever anybody asks about what do game writers do, I tell them to go play What Remains of Edith Finch and understand how they're telling story with gameplay. I think that experience and to answer your question, the entire team that made that game, what they really did phenomenally well was take all the tools that we have as game writers in our toolbox, and they used them all. They didn't just say, oh, you're going to watch cutscene for an hour and a half, right? Like, you know, they kept you immersed in that whole experience and told a variety of very different stories using very different game mechanics to really tell an amazing, fully featured experience. So whatever they move on and do next, I am a fan for life.
How about you, Mel?
I kind of, and I've said this, I may have said this to you guys, but I've definitely said this to John, is like, I feel a lot of the time like a very blasphemous narrative director because a lot of the games that I enjoy playing like aren't story heavy. But I think that what makes games so unique is the experience that they provide. And so it's hard for me to kind of talk about just storytelling. I think like narrative touches so much more than story. It's like the experience as a whole. It's your relationship with the game that you're playing. And there are games that have done that like super well. Like, you know, Edith Finch, you mentioned, is one of them. But also like Florence was my game of the year. And to the same degree that John was talking about, like that studio took everything from that game to make a character shine. Like all the game mechanics, the music, the animation, the storytelling was all geared towards building Florence up as a character. Like everything, you know, like the gameplay is like putting puzzle pieces together and having like a animated argument with little blocks. Like, but it's all like, it makes you understand like who she is and how she's feeling about something at any given moment. And, you know, when a game, you know, I played that and I was like totally blown away. It was like an amazing hour of my life sitting down listening to that, like getting super emotional about it. When a game has that effect on you, like that's what I would say, like that's the experience that you're looking for, is that kind of immersion, that kind of like impact on you. And there's a lot of experimental people out there right now, like trying to change games in different ways and try new things. Like Bree Code is a huge inspiration for me because she's looking at how we interact with narrative and games in a different way that isn't, you know, like headshotting people and you know, stuff that we've seen before. And not that there's anything bad for that. It's just, it's always inspiring for me to see people who are creating space for other points of view, other ideas, and other ways to play games and consume games and what we think is something that falls under the tag of gamer, I say with scare quotes.
We have like 20 minutes left, so I would love to go into that more. I want to go to the other questions. Maybe we'll backtrack into that.
Sure.
John, when you were talking about scope at the beginning of the podcast, I just kept thinking about how the first week when the game came out and game dev was freaking out when they realized, wait, did they really record two versions of every open world line in the game? And that is insane that like that you did that, which I, from our experience, I'd feel like that is a hard argument to win. Mm-hmm. To have that in the game.
Well, it wasn't hard once we played it without it, right?
Yeah.
You know, when you play it and you have everything delivered at like a resting tone, right? Then you feel like it breaks immersion as you're swinging, right?
Yeah.
And then when you play it and you have everything delivered with an exerted tone, if you stop, you know, and he's delivering a line with an exerted tone, then it breaks immersion, right? So the natural solution there was, well, let's just get two assets and switch them on the fly, right? And so we just started doing that. I don't think we knew. I mean, we knew our game was going to have about 30,000 lines. And, you know, that was, we got pretty close. I think we were a couple thousand over, but, you know, that was roughly what we had. And so we, you know, you can look at a schedule and say, okay, we have this many days in the VO booth. And Yuri Lowenthal, by the way, is an amazing actor.
Yeah.
I think I've been, it's funny, I kind of think he's my muse because he's been in, I think, every game I've worked on at Insomniac and even some of the Medal of Honor games at EA that I worked on.
I told John he was turning into Wes Anderson.
Yeah, him and Laura Bailey and Tara Platt have been in a lot of our games. But that's just because they're really good, right?
Yeah.
And so the once you get it in the game and you feel what it's like to have him say a resting line when he's resting, but then exerted when he's swinging, it's like, oh, this makes it so much better, right?
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
It sounds so crazy when you're like walking close to someone and they're yelling at you. It's so not a calming experience.
But you're used to having that happen in games. At least I'm used to that. Like, okay, it's crazy the first time. After that, it's like, all right, I accept that.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, we actually had that discussion. It's like, well, yeah, other games have done it like this. You know, we weren't the first Spider-Man game, but we're like, well, can we do better? And we talked about it and said, yeah, we can do better.
So you looked at the tagline for the game that just says, be better. You're like, that's right, Spider-Man.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. Yes. Go ahead, Mel.
Oh, I was just saying, like, we had something similar. Like, you know, we always mark in a script when we think something is going to be projected, but we'll record the two and decide which one sounds better, whether it's the close-sounding line or the projected line. And then we also had an interesting experience with the two characters, Alexios and Cassandra, because we had to record the set of lines with both actors, and then also we tried to record them first as much as possible, and let them do their own performance on the line, and then have sections of it that Melisanthe would lead and sections of it that Michael would lead, and then hopefully get them in before the other character in the scene, in the recording booth, I mean, like not in mocap, just in the recording booth, and have the other character be able to listen to the delivery before saying their line so that they could get a good like continuity of the script. Because that's one of the biggest challenges with branching dialogue is like, where am I and what's happening?
Yeah.
Yeah. I wish we could do more dual mic sessions or multi-mic sessions and have all the actors there at one time so that they can act off of each other. I know if I were an actor, I would appreciate that. That's why voice actors are so valuable, because they understand how to give a great performance when they're just standing there talking to the wall, right?
Yeah.
But I think they would appreciate it if their acting counterpart, the other character in the scene with them, were actually there and they could, you know, work with them.
Oh, it's so important, because like a voice coach should be, or like a voice director should be there. And if there isn't, then the writer has to step in and do it. Yep. With like the audio engineer to give the actor the energy they need. Mm-hmm. Like when you're explaining the context of the scene, and this is the same with acting anywhere, when you have an audience or you're supposed to be encouraging somebody to feel a certain way, you have to give them that energy first. And that, you're totally right in saying that's why voice actors are so valuable, because, you know, sometimes they stand in a booth and they're like, they say their line and then the audio engineer's like, thank you. We'll review that. All right. Can you do three more takes, please?
Yeah.
You know, and so it's so
with no direction, just, you know, like, yes, just do three more.
Yeah. Just three more. one more. I think, you know, so you get somebody like me or, you know, a very professional audio director that goes in. It's like, okay, it feels like you're hanging off the side of a building. Like, you're gritting your teeth. Like, how do you say it if you were going to, like, clench your teeth through this one? You know, it's that kind of thing.
Yeah, we had a great voice director, Chris Zimmerman, on Spider-Man. And I had done voice directing of our previous projects. But we decided to bring in, you know, a pro for this one. And one of my favorite things that she says sometimes is she'll hear a line, you know, delivered, and she'll just say, "I don't believe you." And then, you know, the actor, of course, will be like, "Fuck, okay, now I gotta get in it," you know. But it's really good. You know, I think good voice directors are really important.
I don't know if you had, either of you would have time for this, but after you would cast actors, would you ever rewrite the characters for those actors because you
can handle their voice?
Yeah, you got to handle their voice. So they brought something that you didn't expect. You wanted to write for that.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say like you write the character and then you bring in this actor and then you're like, oh, now I have to scrap everything, because that's like very unrealistic. But a lot of the times, like what will happen on AC projects is that you have an idea of what you want this character to be. Maybe you've started writing the character already. You know, you have like the bio written up and we have like the fantasy you're going to be playing. And we start looking for actors like right away, because a lot of times we need to be recording throughout production and not just like cram everything at the end. Yeah. And so what ends up happening is you audition these people, you find the person that like really speaks to you, that you're like, this is the person we need to cast, or these are the people that are playing our protagonists or other major characters. And then your writing voice evolves with their voice until it becomes something that really works for the two of them, or the two of you. And so, you know, Jacob and Evie really evolved in Assassin's Creed Syndicate once we knew who was playing each person. Like, we started kind of writing to the personalities of those people, and then they kind of would also play up those personalities for the sake of the script. And it made, I think, for overall better characters. Yeah.
We had a character in Sunset Overdrive. His name was Floyd, and he was actually based on Floyd from, well, the idea of the character was Floyd from True Romance, Brad Pitt's character in True Romance. And so, you know, we had an idea of, you know, who this character would be. And then this actor came in, Larry Heron, and he gave an audition that was still the best audition I've heard. And a lot of times, voice auditions, you just get like an MP3 or a WAV file, you know, delivered to your email inbox, and you'll listen to it, whatever. But this one like made the rounds at the office, right? Like everybody wanted to listen to it. And it wasn't the Brad Pitt character. It was Larry's take on that, but it was so good that he basically created a new character just based on that audition. And we went back and said, okay, we're going to change the way this character speaks, his voice, his, you know, everything about him, how he interacts with the players, just based on who this guy is. So yeah, casting is super important, and it's really hard to get right. I think, you know, it's something that we're all learning as the industry matures, and we're trying to find new voices, new people out there. There's a lot of skills to being a voice actor. There's a lot of skill to being a good actor in general. And casting is just one of those things that, I feel like we need to get better at in general.
Yeah, and it gives a lot of faith, I think, to the writers, too. Once they have a voice to the script that they're writing, it really helps bring those characters and those stories to life. And then I find that, you know, if you are lucky enough to have actors that kind of start with you as well, that it helps informs the scripts, but it also helps, really helps bringing those characters to, like, their full potential, because the writers have already heard that voice. Like, they already know how to kind of write for that character, even if they're writing them for the first time, like months down the line, or, you know, it's a character that pops up in one of their quest lines but wasn't their original voice to start with. And so it's super helpful to get a bigger picture with actors.
I just want to say that I can't pronounce her name, but the Cassandra voice actress.
Yeah, Melisanthi, yeah.
She is incredible, and I want her just to... I would listen to read the phone book or just narrate, like, Google Maps. Like, her voice is so amazing.
Yeah, and she is a very different kind of female protagonist voice than what we've heard before. Like, she brings another, like, flavor to it, and we really needed somebody who was, you know, sassy.
I'm just gonna say the sassiness of her voice is so perfect for her
but
character.
You know, she's got like a little husk to her as well. You know, we didn't want, I don't know why, and I maybe you shouldn't actually put this part on, but like there is a kind of quote female protagonist voice that you hear sometimes. No, but it's not even that, but or it'll sound like I don't know, somebody very weak. Like, it always makes me think of the in you can play a girl, and when she falls off the, I think it was like or something. This is why you can't put it up there, because they'll be like, Melissa McGoobry hates.
I can just bleep this, that'll be fine.
There's a woman, and she's like running away from whatever demon's following you, and then she falls off the cliff, and her yell is like, ah. And it's like, I didn't want that from a protagonist that was going to get her ass kicked and kick other asses, but also be somebody who can forge relationships and have like deeply emotionally like impacting moments with other characters. Like, you need somebody who's super versatile, and we are super happy to find Melisanthi for Cassandra, because she just brings a new layer.
I'm going to keep that because that's good, but I'm just going to bleep out the name of the game.
Thank you.
Everybody's going to think it's Tomb Raider, by the way.
No, my God.
No, also, I'm kidding.
Deep respect for Tomb Raider.
What are you saying, Max?
I was going to say, just I love the voice acting in Spider-Man 2. Don't want to make this thing like we only love Assassin's Creed's voice acting.
What? No, of course not.
But I think that just, you know, goes to show that you know, there's a lot of great voice actors out there, but it's a really tough skill to master. And, you know, I think that may be one of the reasons why you have, you know, a lot of voice actors are in a lot of different games, right? Because they're well known. They have the chops, as they say. So that's why they get cast so often.
This is kind of a general question, but if there's one thing you can change about game development, what would it be?
Only one?
You'd say more come to mind right now. Like, what drives you crazy?
There's not that much that drives me crazy. I think one of the frustrations that I have sometimes is, and it's a frustration with human nature in general, is that everybody procrastinates, right? So, you know, whenever we have a milestone or like an E3 demo or whatever on any game, there's, you know, we know that we have to do it. We know what needs to get done. But why is it always like the week or two before everybody's just like, oh my God, we're not going to make it. We have to work 24 hours a day. You know, like how do we, obviously there's no easy answer. It's just human nature. We either say we're going to do something, even though we know we don't have the time to do it, or we just procrastinate and we're on Twitter all day until shit gets real, you know? And that's just frustrating sometimes that always happens. I don't know that there's an answer to that.
Has Twitter been a boon or a curse to game development?
I think it's both.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because I found people on Twitter that I would have never, like,
been able to. I think you met you through Twitter.
Yeah. I found you guys on Twitter, and it changed my life.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have met a lot of developers on there, and I think this is a common thing that comes up when developers are together, is that there's never enough times in a developer's life where developers actually can get together and talk and have like mature conversations with one another about game development and like critical conversations about game development. Mm-hmm. And Twitter has been a great platform in order to like meet people and then DM them about this kind of stuff. And you know, that's how I met John.
Yeah.
Just John, that's John had reached out to me that way.
Yep.
And then, you know, it's also a lot of angry people. That's a really hard part of game development, is interacting with very, very angry people. And I don't, I mean, like, not in the, not so much like in studios. I mean, yeah, like when your game is out and stuff, that we always want to make games that people will enjoy playing. Like I said this before, it's like nobody wants to make something that's shitty. Everybody wants,
I don't want you to hate this.
Yeah, I don't want anybody to hate it. I just want, I want a lot of different kinds of people to love it. And you know, that's something we're working really hard on now. And I think the industry is taking some pretty good steps forward in terms of, you know, opening up the gaming space to lots of different kinds of people. I just overall wish that to the angry folks out there that they could open their hearts a little bit. I think that would be really nice.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for me,
reach those feelings.
Yeah, one thing kind of related to that is you know, and I understand why this happens, but you know, it takes years to make a game, especially a AAA game. And throughout the course of development, our marketing and PR teams, they have to keep the flames going, right? So they will release various details, stories, gameplay videos, demos, whatever. And as a developer, every time something goes out to the public, it becomes kind of etched in stone. And it's so hard for us to manage that when oftentimes we don't know where we're going to be in a year or two, right? And it's important, you know, for the fans as well to stay excited about the games. But sometimes I wish, like, we could just stay silent until the game releases. Like, Apex Legends, nobody knew about any of that.
I was just going to ask you about this. Like, would you rather have launched your game just out of nowhere?
I don't know. I don't think there's a right answer, because I think if you ask the marketing people, they'll say, well, you need to build awareness for your brand, right?
Yeah, for Spider-Man, you need to build awareness for Spider-Man.
I don't know.
Yeah, you got to be aware of the man that was bitten by a spider.
Yeah, but you know, there's certainly messaging in there, right? Like, if we had released it without anybody knowing anything about it, they would be like, wait, is this a movie tie-in? Is this a, you know, is what is this thing?
I think you can only really do that if you're Beyonce, and then she's like, boom, lemonade, and you're like, yeah, hooray.
Yeah, it's like Michael Jackson popping up from under the stage. It's like, bam, there he is, you know? Yeah, I don't know. It's hard. It's a tough thing. I don't know. Maybe Apex will start a trend.
25 million players, man.
It's crazy.
I do want to ask something, but I don't know if it'd be a good question to end with.
Sure.
I want to know how interested are both of you in having a AAA game that does not have combat as one of the major verbs? Because we tried to talk to someone about this like last year. We couldn't think of any AAA game that's story driven. Period.
Besides Nintendo, maybe.
Besides like Nintendo or racing games.
Wait, you couldn't find a story that was
a AAA story-driven game where combat is not.
Oh, I see.
Part of it.
I was just stuck on the fact that you said that didn't have like a verb in the title, and I was like, spider. And I was like, I know Assassin exists in Assassin's Creed. I would be super, super happy to see a AAA game without combat as the main mechanic, like super happy. And the more we go on, the more that becomes a possibility. I think you had asked me that 5 years ago that I'd be like, well, I don't really see it happening anytime soon.
Yeah.
And it's going to take a lot of work from a lot of people in order to make that a possibility. But I would be over the friggin' moon if that were the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, at its heart, games are about fulfilling fantasies, right? So would you say that, like, Guitar Hero or Rock Band were AAA games?
But they're not story-driven.
But they're not story driven. But
there's a main path in there. I was a guitarist in a terrible band.
I started in a garage and then I went to a stadium. Come on.
And a UFO came out while I played Freebird.
And then I was in a rock band. Yeah, okay.
But I think there are experiences out there. There are fantasies that people have that aren't related to combat. And we need to find those in the AAA space and make them happen. What Remains of Edith Finch is a great example. And I would even say that is a AAA game. Like there's nothing that's any more or less accessible in that game than, you know, anything you see on the shelf from any of the big publishers. It's just a matter of getting that in the player's hands. From a player experience standpoint, it's a very polished, high class, really immersive experience. Return of the Obra Dinn is another great example. Greece or Gris or however you say that. Florence, you know, those are all games where, you know, when you play them, they feel super polished and amazing. Inside is another great, great game. But just because they're not AAA, just because they don't have, you know, $100 million budgets doesn't mean that they're not just as valuable to the player.
This is like kind of off topic, but kind of related. Is it like in the news in the past couple of weeks, like we found out that Farming Simulator 19 was becoming an esport?
Yeah.
Coolest thing ever. Okay. like, you know, you always expect something with shooting to be an esport or, you know, an actual like sports game. But to see something like Farming Simulator break the mold, like gives me joy because I have put many a 100 hour into Farming Simulators myself. Play a lot of Harvest Moon, you know, played Stardew Valley, all that stuff. Like, I've played a ton of games where combat isn't the main focus or a way of playing the game. Like, I'm playing Civ 6 right now. Like, you can do, like, a combat victory for sure, but, like, that whole game is not centered around the fact of, like, killing people. There are different kinds of ways to play that game. This is why I'm a blasphemous narrative director, because I play games where you farm and you have technical approaches to stuff. But, I think it's totally possible, and I think it is an avenue that needs to be explored because there's a lot of people who don't relate to fight or flight stress responses. And, you know, looking at how we can be more experimental in the way we make games on a big scale, like on a AAA scale, will happen one day. We'll get there. Yeah. We just need to, you know, stick together and be friends. Teamwork makes the dream work.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
Yeah.
Good way to
go
end
team.
This. Yeah.
Go team.
So then now we're done. So now we'll go to how can people find both of you on the internet? Like Twitter handles.
Oh yeah. Mine is John Paquette. It's JON. I believe there's an underscore in there. PAQUETTE.
Mine's Melkart the Third, so MELQARTIII.
And you can find this podcast on ScriptLockCast on Twitter. Our art was done by Lily Nishida at Lily Nishida on Twitter, and music done by Tumelo at Tumelo Makes on Twitter. Please leave a review on iTunes. And that's it. Thank you two for coming on.
Thanks so much for having us.
You're
amazing.
Guys.